This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast with Mark Stephen and Rachel Stewart from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello, and thank you for choosing to listen to this. As you know, we build the Scotland Outdoors Podcast from the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland, which is called Out of Doors. And this week, we were celebrating a rather special anniversary.
Out of Doors, celebrating 100 years of the BBC in Aberdeen.
Hello and welcome to a special Out of Doors recorded in our Aberdeen studio to mark 100 years of the BBC broadcasting in the city.
I'm Mark Stephen, and standing right alongside me, Rachel Stewart. And we're delighted to be joined by a small and rowdy audience here at our current BBC headquarters in Aberdeen at Beechgrove Terrace.
I am rather liking your plummy voice.
Oh, see, when I started broadcasting, you had to do that. In England, they called it received pronunciation. They didn't expect us to be able to do that, so they called it educated Scots. You had to broadcast, seriously. Without a word of a lie, you had to try and sound like an educated Scot.
Well, you're sounding the part and indeed looking the part tonight.
Well, you've got to make an effort, haven't you? Some of our audience have too. Certainly the production team have. Who knew that tweed culottes even existed?
Now, almost exactly 100 years ago, on the 10th of October in 1923, the BBC first started broadcasting from this city, not from this site, but on Belmont Street in the city centre. Now, in actual fact, the very first broadcast took place on a stormy night in the Castlegate Square. We've had many stormy mornings since.
Indeed.
And by all accounts, went down very well with the attending crowd.
100 years on, we are still here making radio. And to mark the centenary, we've lined up an excellent panel of guests to transport us back 100 years to tell us what rural life was like, access to the outdoors was like, and what conservation was like back in 1923.
Now, we're not live today. As Mark mentioned, we're recording this very special programme at a much more sociable time in the evening. And hey, we're inside. It's amazing. But you can get in touch with us. We love to hear what you're up to and what you're doing. Email us outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. And just for our audience here at the BBC and our panel of guests, we have a mystery sound. Let's have a listen.
Was that you?
I was thinking it was something to do with your false teeth.
It's possible. I thought it maybe sort of somebody opening a bottle, you know, a nice Beaujolais, something like that. Well, we'll introduce the guest shortly, but anybody any ideas what that might be? They're looking utterly perplexed.
More human-inspired than animal to me.
I did.
All right, OK. You reckon it's human? Well, we shall find out. They've been sitting here patiently, so without further ado, we will introduce our guest line-up for the show. First up, to tell us something about the history of the BBC in Aberdeen, is broadcaster and author Graeme Stewart. Alongside Graeme, taking us back in time and giving us a sense of what was going on in the outdoors 100 years ago, Paula Williams from the National Library of Scotland.
Next to Paula, we've got Stuart Brooks, who's the Director of Conservation and Policy with the National Trust for Scotland, and he's going to give us a picture of the conservation landscape in the 1920s and 30s.
And to paint a picture of rural life in that period, Dr. Tom McCain from the Elphiston Institute at Aberdeen University.
So to kick us off, we're going to have a chat with Graham Stewart. And of course, you'll probably recognise Graham because he is a well-kent face. He is a presenter on Reporting Scotland. And of course, he also presents lots of programmes on BBC Radio Scotland. And you are a real radio enthusiast, Graham.
I'm glad you didn't use the word anorak.
I wouldn't dare. Now, as you know, we're at the BBC. We're at Beechgrove Terrace just now, but that wasn't always the case. Where did we start off?
Started off in the city centre. In Belmont Street at the premises of an electrical company, and the studios were based on the upper floors. And like all broadcasting at the start in 1923, it literally was almost in the back room.
Now, we've got a lovely audio description of what Belmont Street was like from the time, from one of the producers, a guy called John Gray.
Belmont Street was where the station was in those days. It was simplicity itself in one way, although it looked very elaborate at the times. Heavy curtains hung round the room. The producer's office and the control cubicle were one and the same room. The effects were simple, because if you know Belmont Street, the back of Belmont Street looks over Union Terrace railway lines. And, well, it's not too far from Union Street. So if you wanted railway effects or street effects, you were pulled back the curtains and opened one of the appropriate windows on the studio and hoped that a train would come past at the right time. Aberdeen Transmitter was in the grounds of a laundry, which very soon proclaimed itself on all its vans as the Aberdeen Radio Laundry. The actual aerial itself was one of these tubular affairs with the wires in long cylinder hung between the two aerial masts. And a great tale, which I've never been able to find any engineer to confirm or deny, was that as the laundry in those days still hung out all the sheets to dry on wires underneath the aerial, when a lot of wet sheets were hung out to dry, the Aberdeen transmitter changed its frequency. Technically, this is feasible. Whether it happens, I say, is apocryphal. At any rate, what is not apocryphal is that the frequency keeping was not always what might be desired.
I don't care whether that's true or not. I want it to be true. Graham, the first day's broadcasting, I mean, how excited were people in Aberdeen about that?
Hugely. I mean, there's a massive reaction to it. Now, not everybody obviously had a radio set at that time, but all the electrical companies and the shops which sold wireless sets or equipment to make your own wireless sets, that was quite popular at the time. People went along to those shops, either went indoors, some of the shops erected loudspeakers, so people were actually out on the streets listening to that first night's broadcast. There's a restaurant, actually, in Union Street that advertised the fact that radio was happening tonight, and the diners got to listen in to the radio station when it launched. So it was a big event in Aberdeen, even if radio was still in its infancy, even if very few people actually had radio sets, it was a big event.
And Belmont Street was in operation for a while, wasn't it? Mm. When did it end?
So it ended in 1938 when the BBC moved to Beechgrove, not in this actual building, but at this site.
When I came up to work in BBC Aberdeen for a start, it was in the old Beechgrove house. If I have to visualise what a radio studio was, I always think of that place. Mm. It was so full of history, and you know, there was a richness to it that's very difficult to, you know, replicate nowadays.
And there were lots of broadcasting houses throughout the country, and they literally were just that. They were old houses, old mansions, you know, of 8, 9, 10 rooms in them. Obviously, they were owned by posh families, but they were ideally suited to broadcasting because they had big individual rooms that could be used as individual studios. And broadcasting house here in Aberdeen was a big old building, had lots of studios. They actually erected an extension and had a big music studio you could fit an orchestra in. Not a full-scale orchestra, but nonetheless, an orchestra that you could have playing music on the radio. I mean, it was amazing.
Yeah, and a sprung dance floor, as I recall.
Yeah.
We were talking earlier about the difference between received pronunciation and educated Scots. This is definitely RP. This is the Marchioness of Aberdeen and Tymer at the opening of the new studio at Beechgrove in November 1938.
My Lord Provost, Mr. Ogilvie, Mr. Dinwiddie, and friends, seen and unseen, I am grateful for the kindly and gracious act of the British Broadcasting Corporation, which has done me the honour of inviting me to perform the opening ceremony of this new Aberdeen headquarters. But 15 years ago, we in Aberdeenshire not unnaturally wondered what effect wireless would have on the life of the country people. Would it bring new interests into their oft-times hard and drab life? Would it give a new joy to rural life? Would it perchance do something to stem the drift from the country to the city? That latter drift, alas, goes on. But how immeasurably brighter and fuller has country life been made. Tonight, we in Aberdeen feel ourselves part of a greater whole, which goes from strength to strength. And so I pray that peace and felicity may dwell in this house, and that from it there may still go forth the things which make men glad and the things by which men live. I declare this new headquarters open.
it's a lovely turn of phrase, that, friends seen and unseen, because essentially that's what radio's about. You know, that's what we do week in, week out, and I've never heard it put better than that. How were people able to listen at that time, out in the countryside?
The signals of the early stations didn't actually stretch that far. I mean, officially, it would be 25 miles if you had what was known as a crystal set, which you could build yourself. If you were really posh, you had a valve radio set, and depending on how many valves were installed in it, you could actually receive programmes as far away as London. So if you had a fancy five-valve set, you could hear programmes from the big cities. Over time, that got more difficult because as radio spread throughout Europe and European countries followed the lead of the BBC, the airwaves became quite congested, and it was difficult enough hearing your own local radio station, let alone one from miles away. So in those early days, even before the Aberdeen station, people were listening to London and they were listening to Glasgow. But it was interesting that clip there, we had a laugh there listening to the speech talking about, you know, simple country life and how people might actually get something out of radio. That was a real concern in the 1920s, this idea of rural depopulation, of people moving away from the rural areas to the big cities. And it was felt that broadcasting could maybe stem that kind of fleeing to the cities. Because one of the interesting things about the Aberdeen station is it was the first BBC station to launch with the ability to link up with other stations in places like London. It was called simultaneous broadcasting. And although it's quite controversial now, we talk about networking in radio, about local radio being destroyed because programmes are increasingly coming from London, what you've got to remember is, in the early days, everything was local. So a station that had programmes coming from London, that was quite exotic. I mean, if you're living in Aberdeenshire and you're able to hear an orchestra playing from the Albert Hall in London, that would blow your mind. So that was a very important part of broadcasting in a rural area. People did actually want to hear programmes from London. It's a bit different now because, you know, so much now comes from London and people maybe are arguing for local radio to come back. But back then it was the other way around.
That's because it was a break from our hard and dread lives. Thank you, Graham. And we're going to come back to that. And this issue about what life was like in rural Scotland is something we want to explore a little bit more. At the Highland Folk Museum near Newton Moor has a fabulous crofting section, and I visited it recently and spoke to volunteer Sandy MacDonald, who's from a farming background. He took me on a tour which started in one of the workers' cottages.
It was made of tin. It was quickly built, cheap to build. There was two rooms. There was the bed in the sitting room, or in the main room, the good room at the end. And at the far end, there was a little living room or a little sitting, you know, kitchen.
Now, this was built in the 1880s.
1890.
But it was still very much on the go in the 1920s. In fact, even beyond that.
It was used right up to 1970. There was folk in it then, waiting for a house in Newton Moor. But it had everything, apart from water, light and a toilet. But if you look next door, there's a wee closet in there, which was dry, but there was the bath. So that was brought in here on a Friday night. The girls were bathed, then the boys, for the weekend. So it was the basic facilities were here.
Can we go and have a look at it? Mm-hmm. Ah, so I can see the toilet itself, and it does look like a toilet.
It isn't, yes. But there was a pail underneath and you had to be emptied. So that was a horrible job the dad got.
Not the luxury of a button.
No.
And as you say, this is where the bath would be. In fact, there's a bath here beside us.
Yes. The kids would be in there. The parents would bath when the kids were all in bed. And this was the boiler for the heating the water. You put the fire in there, the water was in here. You took it out and poured it in the bath.
And of course, at that time, there was no running water. You had to go and get it.
That's right. The water came from the barn just across the road there.
And you can hear with the tin roof the rain battering against it.
It must have been noisy in a wet night, and it must have been cold in the frosty weather.
How many people would have lived in a house like this then?
Well, we had a woman in 4 years ago, and her and her mother and father, and there was 11 children. I said, where did you all live? And she said, we existed. Aye? And it was a house the same as this. And when you think the good room at the other end, it was only used for the minister coming or weddings or a funeral.
Aye? So even if you had 11 children, some of them wouldn't be popped in there. It would have been kept as the good room for special occasions.
It was nobody got into the good room, no.
In terms of what they were producing on the croft, what kind of things would it have been here?
Well, they would have had potatoes, they would have had milk and butter, cheese, flour for bread. So they would have had the basic commodities, and they would poach. Poaching was a big thing in the Highlands, you know. There was always deer or salmon. You know, then the river was just full of salmon. But now it's just completely different, right?
Now, we've got some of the farm buildings, the traditional farm buildings, just beside us. Shall we have a look in there?
This is the dairy we're coming to.
And most crofters and farmers at that time would have had a cow, would they?
Oh, yes, yes. Probably two, so that when one was giving milk, the other one was in calf waiting. And when one calved, the other one was going then to its lactation. Well, this is a cream separator. You turned the handle, and you turned it so fast till the bell rang. And when the bell rang at the side, that was the cream ready to come away from the milk. That was it separated. This one here is for taking the whey out of cheese again. The whey went out the hole in the corner into a bowl, and that was used for food. There's the handles down the bottom. This is a butter churn again. It's the plunger one. It went up and down, and you kept thinking that till the butter turned.
So again, quite hard work, Sam.
It was. It was all hard work. In the dairy was the wife's domain. She would do that, and the daughter. But the wife would be the main, and she would be the one that milked the cow and everything. And because she had quite a busy, hard life as well, because the husband would be working all day. So she had to look after, you know, animals, things like that. So her life was hard. This was the byre.
And this is where, of course, the cattle would have been.
They were all tied by the neck.
And I can see a milking stool in the end there.
They were still hand milking, yes.
Yeah, so still hand milk in the 1920s.
The 30s, it was beginning to change into the modern way of milking the cows. But it was still the early start in the morning.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking, what, 5 o'clock?
5 o'clock, mm-hmm. They would be out to get. It had to go in the train, you see. You'll see the just down the bottom, there's the churns for the railway. So it went away in the train.
And where was it taken to? Where were the markets?
This would be Inverness. But there was three dairies here. There was one at Glentruim, one up the hill there, and one in Canusi. So there was three local dairies. And in the early 1900s, there was a dairy in Newton Moor. Nothing now. No, nothing now.
Does that make you feel a bit sad when you think there's nothing like that
now? I know, that just all changed. Aye. And there's more people now. It's all just disappeared. That's modern life. The main building in the trough was the stable. The horse was the main thing in the farm.
Yeah, of course, a worker. The horse was a big worker.
Everything was based on the horse. It got the best of everything. And the first horseman, he was thought the world of, he got the best of everything too. He was served first at meal times, got out of the stable, he was first out, he got the best jobs. So as the horses, you know, second, third, that went down, the jobs deteriorated. This is where they would congregate at night, the men and the boys. They'd be sitting in the kiss with the bothy ballads, banging their feet against the keeping time. I had no other entertainment. And they had no really any money to go anywhere, so they made their own entertainments. Somebody would have an accordion. They'd just all sit down and start singing, aye?
As I get up the offer for to get happy, I met in with Jimmy Brown, with him I did agree. Come I dum do, come I do a day, I dum do, come I do day. Now I engaged to Jimmy Brown in the year of 91, for the guy's second pair and be his or a man. Come I dum do, come I do a day, I dum do, come I do dee. When I get him, the guy's a two, it was on an evening.
The guy's a two, sung there by Jimmy McBeath, and we also heard from Sandy MacDonald, volunteer at the Highland Folk Museum. Dr. Tom McCain is director of the Atherston Institute at Aberdeen University. As Sandy said there, these houses had everything. Except water, electricity and toilets. I mean, how representative was that of sort of rural living at the time?
Well, extremely. And as I've learned over the years, owning a stone house, they're water resistant rather than watertight. So they require a lot of work, a lot of maintenance, and there's a lot of wind through sash windows. And basically one room of the house would have been heated at best. In the kitchen area, there are most of these rural farmhouses, two up, two down farmhouses, have fireplaces upstairs, but maybe they would have been lit when somebody was sick or in childbirth or something like that. But otherwise, the rest of the house would have been very cold and rather inhospitable. And the beautiful special room, of course, Ben the Hoos, kept for special occasions which almost never happen.
Sandy mentioned some of the different roles that there would have been on a farm at that time. Talk us through the kind of labour that would have been on a farm in the 1920s.
Well, something to remember is that everything was done by hand before mechanisation. I mean, there were mechanical devices which helped with reaping and stooking and all that sort of thing, binding, come the end of the 19th century. But still in the 1920s, it was horses and men and women who did a lot of the work. Indeed, in slightly earlier times, bondagers, women would actually pull the ploughs, actually women pulling ploughs with men guiding them behind. But onwards to the 1920s, a lot of handwork to be done, and therefore a lot of staff needed for even a medium-sized farm. So a small farm of 30 acres would have a couple of farm servants. A big farm like Drumidelgi towards the end of the 19th century and well into the 20th century would have had 30 people, and really its own Ferumtún. And this is where the Ferumtúns come in, because they were their own little villages. They'd have a blacksmith, and the hierarchy of farm servants and the people who worked on the farms would go down from the owner to the grieve, who would organise all the work and tell people what to do. Then we have the ploughman, the next people in the ladder of status, the first ploughman, second ploughman, third ploughman, fourth ploughman, you know, all the way down. And finally you get oraloons or baililoons, who would have to do with the cattle. Oraloons are just the people who do ahing, which means muck the hens, is what they had to start with. And the kitchy deems, looking after the milking and the butter making, as we heard in that recording. And when you moved from one farm to another every 6 months, you wanted to move up that tree and eventually become maybe a cotter, so you could have a place where you could stay for a year or 2 years or 3 years and actually sort of maybe plan a life to some extent. So that's one reason the farm servants were often very young, you know, 14 years old up to the age of 20-something. I've spoken to Bothyloons, people up until the 1950s who started maybe in the 1920s and 30s with Bothy life. They talked about feeing. It wasn't a six-month fee at that time. It was more like a year or two. People lived in Bothy's unheated little buildings, and one man told me, Murray Smythe, told me about the mattresses that they used to have, calf-filled mattresses, so this chaff from the threshing. And if you felt something at night, you just reached down and you grabbed it and you squeezed it till it stopped moving. And then you got back to sleep, and in the morning you'd take your mattress apart and take out the wee moosey. And that was just life. It was unheated, it was cold, it was full of wildlife that you didn't want in the home. It was a hard life.
But generally happy, maybe.
Oh, of course, they were all very happy. The happy rural workers singing their happy songs.
We heard a lovely Bothy ballad at the end of Sandy's interview. Tell us a little bit about the tradition of that and, I suppose, the connections to the land.
Well, the Bothy songs are totally connected to the land. They arose really at the beginning of the 19th century with this tradition of farm servants moving from farm to farm. And one of the only ways they had to entertain themselves was singing songs. And there were all sorts of traditional songs from all over the place, all over Britain and Ireland and elsewhere, which were sung in the Bothies. But usually the term Bothy song is a song that refers specifically to farm work. It describes the farm work. At 5 o'clock, we quickly rise and hurry down the stair to get our horses corned and fed, likewise to strake their hair. At 5 o'clock, you go and feed and deal with the horses before you get your own meal, before you even get your pints a tie, before you even tie your shoelaces. You feed and take care of the horses. Very important on a farm. So these songs reflected the lifestyle. They reflected the work. They all talk about the work. And they reflected the mean and nasty farmers. The farmer of this Muckletoonie is gay, hard and sair.
It's interesting that, actually, because that's a very old-established theatrical tradition. You can go back to classical Greek theatre, you know, and the great and the good were getting lampooned from the stage. Commedia dell'arte in Italy, exactly the same thing. It's almost like a safety valve for the farm workers that they can sing songs about the farmer and really rip it out of them.
Yes, and that's a tradition in the Scots language and also the Gaelic tradition, is that you can say things in songs that you can't say in speech, and you certainly can't say to the person involved in speech. And also, having said that, there are a number of songs, plenty of songs in praise of the farm, in praise of the horses, in praise of the farmer, who's very fair and treats his workers well. So there's a mixture. But it was definitely a safety valve, a way that people could say things, give them license to say things they couldn't otherwise say, and maybe even possibly to warn other farm servants at the markets and fairs that, you know, dinna ging air, he's gay hard and sair, dinna deet.
And would there have been any other forms of entertainment at the time? Sandy was saying that was kind of it for a lot of them.
Well, songs, but there would have been melodeons, there were fiddles, homemade fiddles, there were spoons, there were jew's harps or jaws harps or trumps, as they're called in the Northeast. There's dunting your heels on the kist for a bit of rhythm as you sing the song. So that was really much of the pastime. Come 1920s and 30s, of course, as radio comes in, and I think pretty much everybody I've spoken to from that era calls it the wireless rather than radio. Radio is a fairly newfangled term for most of the people that I've spoken to. So you'd get the wireless with some of the broadcasts. But also at the same time, I spoke to a lovely man, Gordon Easton, up in Tyree, not Tyree, but Tyree here in the East Coast. And he used to have a visitor who'd come round every Friday night on his little motorcycle with a gramophone and the latest 78 recordings strapped to the back. And they'd have an evening of gramophone music, the latest things from the shops. So he would just come round, go from house to house. Another lovely man I spoke to learned one of the songs, the Big Kilmarnock Bunnet, off one of these records, but he missed the first verse out because there was a chip out of the edge of the record. So he never heard the first verse of it. So technology affects the way tradition works and the way tradition forms as well.
It was interesting what you said about how radio took over, but actually radio used the Bothy songs as material for quite a long time afterwards. Interesting, they're always referred to as Bothy ballads. Were they always just ballads, or is that just because it's a nice alliteration?
Well, that's because, it's a nice alliteration, and I use the word bothy song because I'm a folklorist, and so there's a very technical meaning of the word ballad, which isn't that.
Right.
But they're songs that tell stories. They're songs that are what called occupational songs about the work. And as you suggest, in the 20s and 30s, radio became a medium for those songs and also a way for those songs to develop into much more music hall style, more entertaining sort of nostalgic style. As that way of life receded into the past, the songs became much more rosy. When I was only 10 year old, I left the parish squeal. My father feed me to the mains to jaws milk and meal. I first put on my narrow breeks to have my spinal trams and buckled through my knapping knees a pair of Nicky Tams. Now that's a very nostalgic song about how wonderful the life was, and she clots a muckle piece to me with different kinds of jam. That's Northeast emotion right there.
Food.
They're much more humorous songs and much more nostalgic about looking back at this lifestyle that was beginning to fade. So the songs transform into something else for sure.
Just out of curiosity, in the audience itself, our esteemed panelists here, what's your earliest memories of radio?
My parents had an old valve radio about yay big, and if you only remembered when the programme was that you wanted to listen to a few minutes beforehand, you'd missed it by the time it warmed up.
Yes. See, my mum and dad had one of those radios too, but there was a dial in the front, and the wee needle went across. It's places like Helsinki and Moscow and things like that, hugely exotic places.
I remember my grandparents having a big valve radio that filled the top of the table. Yeah. And it was Bakelite, and they were using it in the early 1980s still.
Bakelite had a particular smell when it heated up too. Later, we're going to imagine what people did for leisure in the outdoors 100 years ago and the early days of conservation.
We're not live this morning, but we always love hearing from you, so do get in touch with us. You can email us at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Now, just for our audience here in the studio and for our guests, let's have another listen to the mystery sound.
We've had a less than helpful clue communicated through our lugs, which is apparently it's related to radio. MD any the wiser? I've worked in radio for 30 years. I haven't the faintest idea what they're talking about. We're joined this morning by broadcaster Graeme Stewart, Paula Williams from the National Library of Scotland, Stuart Brooks, Director of Conservation and Policy with the National Trust for Scotland, and Dr. Tom McCain from the Offson Institute at Aberdeen University. We haven't quite been doing this for 100 years. We're not quite that old, but if we had been, what would we have been reporting on back then? Well, we talk about conservation a lot in the current programme. Conservation back in 1923 was really in its infancy, and here to tell us more about that is Stuart Brooks, Director of Conservation and Policy with the National Trust for Scotland. What were the talking points, Stuart, back in 1923?
It was pretty broad. I think one of the interesting things that I've discovered, gleaned, from going back in time 100 years, is that beauty, it seemed, was a much more significant value that we ascribed to the landscape and really kind of formed the basis of a lot of the organisations that were then kind of set up to actually protect the countryside. Wildlife was disappearing. We'd lost the sea eagle by 1917. It was interesting to hear the account of the salmon in the river and the description of how they were prolific and now almost gone. And there's this concept in nature conservation of shifting baselines. So every generation kind of goes out and think, wow, this is amazing. I can see a bird. I can see this amazing flora. And if you took them back 100 years, more often than not, it would be significantly different. And obviously go back and go back and go back. We've had kind of waves of species coming and going in this country. And, back in the day, in the 1920s, we were pretty full on exterminating in quite an industrial way quite a lot of our wildlife, particularly in the uplands. And as I say, the sea eagle was probably one of the last kind of great birds to disappear from the uplands back just before the BBC was formed.
And were people concerned about that or not really? Or what kind of things were the talking points, the concerns at the time?
Yeah, they were. And that was one of the foundations, really, of organisations like the National Trust and the National Trust for Scotland. If you'll indulge me slightly, because I did go back and have a look at some of the archives, and there was a fascinating and fantastic debate that was happening at the time around planning. And so how can we protect the beauty of the landscape and the countryside? So this debate took place in Westminster back in the day. Mr. Buchan, who was a Tory party member, and I'm not going to attempt an accent. So he said, we ought to avoid any fussy aesthetic standpoint. There are many people who are thrown into a state of nervous collapse when they hear of any development and cry out that it is ruined. This is really not common sense. If members of this house could be transported back to the Middle Ages, they would find nothing of the traditional beauty, but a land on the whole rather ugly. Great stretches of undrained marsh, great masses of shaggy woodland, and perched upon points of vantage, raw new Norman castles like gaunt factories. So he was, I think, ascribing a kind of sense of aesthetic, I would say, to man's dominion over nature.
Well, what's interesting there, Stuart, is that what he's describing as being a bad thing is what they're trying to achieve nowadays.
Absolutely. So we are coming around a little bit full circle. He actually talks about a rather new development at the time. And he says, I do not believe that there is any one of these uses which, if properly handled, and he was talking about industrialisation, really, of the landscape, cannot be made at any rate inoffensive and may even add to the charm of the landscape. I take one of the most controversial cases of all, that of the pylons, which carry the electric power cables. No doubt these pylons, if mishandled, can be made horrible monstrosities. But the other day I watched the line of pylons coming over the shoulder of Schehallion, descending from the north into the Perthshire valleys, and it seemed to me that they were more impressive and picturesque than ugly. So he was making a case, really, for development. And so he was on one side of the argument. And of course, predating all of this, and really one of the founding fathers of nature conservation was John Muir. So John Muir, the famous Scot who founded the national parks and the first one in the US in 1872. And I think that was one of the kind of first key points, really, in nature conservation, where it was felt necessary to protect the landscape from ourselves. And the other interesting dimension for John Muir was that not only was he interested in protecting places of beauty and nature, but also to provide people with access to it. And that was really the kind of principle, if you like, of national parks.
Is it not quite a dangerous principle, though, actually, trying to legislate on the basis of beauty? Because your concept of beauty could be completely different to mine. You know, it isn't, as they say, it's in the eye of the beholder. It's subjective.
Yeah, it very much so. So when we look at nature conservation policy now, although there are strategies and policies in place to help try to protect the landscape, we're seeing now, I would say, much more effective protection for nature, for wildlife. And we're even now kind of thinking about protecting other values of nature. We call it natural capital, so things like the carbon that's locked up in the soils. So these policies now, I think, became much more significant in the fight to protect nature in the countryside rather than the aesthetic, the beauty, which was really one of the kind of founding principles of developing organisations like the National Trust and the National Trust for Scotland.
Joining us in the audience this evening is, well, he's an out-of-doors regular, he's practically on pension now, bird reporter for the North East, Ian Broadbent. Ian, Stuart was talking there about sort of the origins of the National Trust. Was bird watching actually a recognised activity at the time? Would it have been the same as today?
Well, there were certainly bird watchers active in the 1920s and way before that. The RSPB, for example, was founded in the 1880s as a campaigning organisation, really to protect birds from things like the trade in exotic feathers for the fashion trade. But probably the big difference between now and then is the quality of the optics that they used. So you wouldn't have high-quality binoculars, telescopes and digital cameras that we have now. So the equipment of the birdwatcher would be very different. And the saying, what's hit is history, what's missed is mystery, comes from really the shotgun would be the tool of choice. If you saw something interesting, you would shoot it to prove that you had seen what you had seen. So the early ornithologists would be dressed very much like yourself, Mark, in tweed, but would be adept with a shotgun.
That probably makes us all feel a bit uneasy, because it's certainly not what we do
nowadays.
Made
the birds feel uneasy.
When did that stop then?
Well, people still shoot birds today, but shooting for collection, you know, it's not really a thing since the 1950s, I would say. But the early ornithologists certainly would collect specimens for museums. And you can still see specimens in drawers at the National Museum of Scotland of birds. But also there was quite a considerable trade in stuffed birds. So it was quite a talking point for the aristocracy to have a collection of stuffed birds in the parlour at the time. And some of these things were quite, it was quite lucrative. So the last great auks, for example, were shot for the stuffed bird and museum specimens. Probably the most famous ornithologists of the time in Scotland in the 1920s were the so-called Good Ladies of Fife. This was Dr. Evelyn Vida Baxter and Leonora Jeffrey Rintoul. And these were childhood friends, independently wealthy, and they would go on annual pilgrimages to the Isle of May to study bird migration and shoot a lot of them as well. But these were the founding fathers or founding mothers, really, of Scottish ornithology. They went on to found the Scottish Ornithologists Club. They wrote together the first version of the Birds of Scotland. And, they shot a lot of birds in the process. But their theories of migration and how weather affects migration still hold good today.
Were they actually recognised at the time?
Yes, yes. They were the sort of experts, the go-to experts, and not a lot got past them. If a record was not bona fide, then Rintoul and Baxter would have their say-so on it.
And egg collecting as well. Did that come to an end in the 1950s?
Egg collecting still carries on even to this day, sadly, but certainly as a widespread activity, it was something that school kids did in the sort of 1950s, 60s and 70s. But really, by the time I started birdwatching in the 1970s, it was certainly something that was frowned upon and thought to be very naughty. And as bird recorder, even today, I have to sort of be very guarded with the information that I have on rare birds and where they nest.
Ian, thank you very much. That was really interesting. And we're now going to bring in Paula Williams, who's from the National Library of Scotland. Paula, one thing that I'm really interested in is what those women might have been wearing who were experts in birds at the time. They were going out shooting birds. What were they dressed in?
The women really struggled to find things that they could wear to go outside, and some of them comment at the time that they have to go to places like Forsyth's department store in Edinburgh, where they had a really good boys' department, so they could buy tweed breeches. It was the only place they could get them because they just weren't made for women. And they would tend to wear them underneath skirts. It was frowned upon even after the First World War for women to be seen in trousers. So they often wore breeches underneath the longer, it tended to be tweed and wool, longer skirts, maybe, I don't know, 6 inches above your ankle. Still not really short, but at least you could move around in them. And then they would take the skirts off to do kind of more serious climbing. Although we've been having a bit of a discussion with some other people who are interested in women's mountaineering about the advantages of wearing skirts. So today you can now buy little really lightweight kind of scarves that you can tie on around your outdoor trousers to go and have a wee. And we were saying that actually wearing a skirt makes all of that much easier. And there are some mountaineers, a lady called Fanny Bullock Workman, and we have her archive at the library, who was kind of derided at the time because she refused to not wear a skirt. But up in the Himalayas, I can kind of see that a woolly skirt and long bloomers and woolly tights would be quite cosy, but also much easier to just pop behind a boulder with. And I think those kind of really practical things are things that you never think about what women would have been doing at the time.
I'm quite interested in the mountaineering side of things. When did that really start gathering some momentum as a pastime?
As a pastime. So in 1923, our centenary, there were only three mountaineering clubs in Scotland. There was the Scottish Mountaineering Club, which was and still is a properly kind of serious mountaineering club for experienced people with the appropriate qualifications, and you have to be kind of sponsored to become a member. There was the Ladies Scottish Climbing Club, which was started in 1907 by the wife of one of the members of the SMC, Jane Ingalls Clark, and her daughter and a couple of other women.
And still on the go today?
Still, the LSCC is still on the go. It was started, I think, because Jane was quite frustrated. She had done some of the really early rock climbing with her husband and Harold Rayburn and others in Glencoe and on Ben Nevis, and put up some really important early rock routes. And she'd written about them in the SMC journal. But because she was a woman, she wasn't allowed to join. So she went off and set up the LSCC. And the other one was the Cairngorms Club, based here in Aberdeen. And it was a club for both men and women to join, and has been all the way from the start. And lots of women went on their very first meet, and it's still extant today as well. But then over the next 10 years, we see a real burgeoning of all sorts of other clubs. So the Ptarmigan Club, the Craigdhu, the university mountaineering clubs all start round about that kind of time, and the Junior Mountaineering Club of Scotland. And they wanted to make it easier for people to become mountaineers. Effectively, with the First World War, the SMC had kind of stagnated. They had lost an entire generation of young men. And the young men who were coming through in the late 20s, early 30s, didn't want to be climbing with all these ancient blokes, and they wanted to do their own thing. And actually, they didn't have the experience. And how do you get the experience? So their only qualification was that you had to be more than 17, and then they would take folk out and teach them how to climb. And the idea was that they would be a feeder for the Scottish Mountaineering Club.
In the 1920s, you've got the attempts being made on Everest at the time, you know, Mallory and Irvine and things, you know. Were people interested? I mean, obviously the people who went mountaineering were interested in mountaineering, but were the rank and file, everybody else who didn't actually put boots on and wander off into the hills, were they interested in mountaineering?
I think that there's kind of two elements to this. So one is that I think it's really important that we remember that all those people that Tom was talking about who live out in the rural areas had been doing outdoor stuff forever. Just because there's no record of working class farm town people going out and walking and going up mountains, I simply refuse to believe that on a long, slow, hot summer Scottish night, some wee dairymaid and goat herd up on a shealing didn't walk out together to the nearest mountain top. You just would, you know. So people had been doing it forever. So the kind of outdoor stuff that we're talking about here is about people who had moved into the cities, and you're making an effort to go to the outdoors. You're not living in it. Yeah. So there's a kind of different thing. So with the Everest expeditions, which were reconnaissance expeditions, it was an idea that Everest was the third pole. We'd lost getting to the South Pole with Scott just at the beginning of the First World War, the kind of horrific death of all the South Pole party on their way back, which chimed beautifully with the go off and die for your country kind of narrative that was going on at the time. But Britain desperately, desperately wanted a pole of its own, And they sent these reconnaissance parties to Everest to get to the highest point. So there was one in 1921, a couple of Scots involved, Harold Rayburn again, who'd put up those routes in Glencoe and on Ben Nevis, who sadly fell ill on the route in. It took weeks to walk in because you had to go through Tibet at that point to get there, which meant that you didn't have very long on the mountain. And then again the following year, 1922, big avalanche, seven Sherpas were killed, and Mallory and the others were there, and it was all over the newspapers because it was such a desperate thing for us to get to the pole. And then there was another attempt in 1924 and so on. And I think big mountains became desirable because of that. But the reason why normal people, if you like, went mountaineering wasn't because of the big stories. It was because they had some more free time, a little bit more free money to spend. And people wanted to get out of the cities. And after the war, they had bicycles, they had access to cars, better public transport. And all of that meant that people could find their way out.
We're going to come back and talk more about that, because that in itself is fascinating. It's kind of the democratisation of the countryside. Yeah. You know, people getting access to it and enjoying it. Thanks very much for that, Paula. I'll just say at the moment, for those of you who have just tuned in, you're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland. We are celebrating 100 years of broadcasting from the city of Aberdeen. We are not, however, the only ones celebrating our rich history.
No, indeed. Our sister programmes, Travelling Folk and Take the Floor, have also been inviting audiences into the BBC here to enjoy the music and culture of this part of the world. And you can find those programmes on BBC Sounds. They're a fabulous listen.
Let's go back to broadcaster Graeme Stewart now. You obviously have an interest in the history of broadcasting too. How did that come about?
Simply, I found myself growing up, listening to radio, watching TV, and wondering how it all came about. And also this weird thing in Scotland where the majority of broadcasting came from London, but some of it came from Scotland, some of it was local. Who decides on the balance of that? Who decides how many Scottish programmes you put on? So that all interested me, and I went out to find a book about it all, and there wasn't one. So I think that a lot of people, if you speak to them who write books, it's because they were compelled to, because the book that they wanted to read didn't exist. So then the penny drops and you think, actually, I'm starting to become interested in this. I'm starting to research it. Maybe this lands to me. Maybe I'm the person that writes the book. And that's really what started this research project.
Yeah. Tell us about some of the programmes then that were broadcast from Aberdeen.
Yeah, it was interesting. We're talking about the outdoors there. I mean, obviously, farming programmes were big in the northeast, and we see them from the early days of broadcasting here. We see regular farming bulletins and fishing bulletins, but also just in terms of talking about the outdoors, there was a series back in about 1935, and it was on John Strachan's farm in Fyvie. And the whole point of it was to document the farming year month by month. So each month, they would look at a particular aspect of farming. The difficulty back then was there was no recording material, so you had to do it live. So they went out to, you know, the farmhouse and had all the equipment. I think they used the kitchen or something like that to put all the equipment in, and had to go back month after month, which in the winter months was quite difficult because obviously it was dark, and there's a few stories of some of the people involved in the programme falling over in the mud and having to continue speaking into the microphone when they're flat on their backs. So that was a hugely ambitious early example of an outside broadcast.
Because it wasn't really until, is it the late 30s, that they could record material?
Yeah, this just came a few years before the advent of recording. It started off with recording vans, and there were a lot of series in the late 1930s that went out into the country. One particular series called The Scottish Countryside made its mission to go to all parts of Scotland and try and record things. It's all very well doing it live, but it's quite difficult doing it live. So actually recording the sounds of the countryside are much easier to do in that environment than in a live broadcast, obviously.
One programme in particular caused a bit of a stir, didn't it?
Yes, this was the Reverend Ronald Selby Wright. He was the minister at Canongate Kirk in Edinburgh. But during the war, he became a padre, basically a chaplain who goes out with a battalion and is there for kind of moral and spiritual support. And because he'd had some broadcast experience in Scotland back in the 1930s, the army was quite keen that some of the young men who were stationed right throughout Britain during the Second World War, they were stationed at anti-aircraft gun sites. So they were quite lonely. They were by themselves. And they came up with this idea that broadcasting could actually help kind of alleviate that loneliness, and you could have a padre of the airwaves, which is what he became. So he became a massive figure in broadcasting and in national life throughout the Second World War, because there was no actual Scottish broadcasting. For reasons of national security, local broadcasting, regional broadcasting had to shut down. But a number of Scottish people like him were broadcasting to the whole of the UK. So he became quite a star in his day with his radio padre talks. At one stage, he, in connection with his military work, was stationed in the north of Scotland, and he was doing his regular day job from Aberlour House in Moray, which, interestingly now, is the headquarters of Walker Shortbread. But at the time, the military took it over, and he thought, actually, I can continue my broadcasts here by travelling to Aberdeen. So it was a 140-mile round trip. He went to the Aberdeen studios, which was here at Beechgrove during the war. And one day he gets this letter, comes through the post, and it's marked top secret. So he opens it up, and inside it is another envelope marked top secret. So he opens that envelope, and inside there's a letter that says, the War Office would like to meet with you. Can you attend at this certain Aberdeen hotel on a certain date at a certain time? And when he got there, he was told by a representative of MI9, which was set up during the war, really to, it was part of the intelligence service, obviously, but it was designed to get prisoners of war back home. And they suggested that during his radio padre talks that he could insert coded messages which would get through to prisoners of war and give them instructions.
We actually have a clip of the radio padre, the Reverend Ronald Selby Wright, talking about those coded broadcasts. Let's just have a listen to that.
As people had been listening to my talks in the prisoner of war camps, I didn't know this, of course, and nobody else was meant to know it, because they were all hidden instruments under floors and things. So when the War Office, or the Ministry of Defence, or whatever it's called these days, they decided that one way of passing messages would be through my talks. Now, I felt this was rather dishonourable. I didn't like it, but I was told to do it, and I was in the army, and I had to obey orders. And so my talks latterly were many of them coded. When I began the talk with Good Evening Forces, it meant I was going to code my talk for a bit. And when I came to the word but, it meant the code was finished.
That's fascinating, isn't it? That's the Reverend Ronald Selby Wright. And that was taken from a programme tracing the life of the radio padre, first transmitted in 1997. He became a big star, and at one point he was getting 1,000 letters a day, which is even more than you get in terms of your fan.
In my life.
Must have been quite difficult, maybe. Just a minute. I wonder who his handler was and that, where he was getting the coded information from, how it was passed on. Do you know that?
All the scripts during the war had to go by the censor anyway, but I think somebody else got involved and inserted these particular messages. I mean, he didn't like doing the work. He felt uneasy with it, but he was essentially you know, he's under orders, so he had to do it. But it was interesting, a lot of the producers at the time, I mean, nobody in the BBC knew anything about it, so a lot of the producers were kind of confused that it was always his scripts that came in late, and they used to say, he was an awful man, that Reverend D. He never got the scripts in on time, but it wasn't his fault.
Yeah, actually, talking about producers, we're very pleased to have in our audience tonight Stuart McFarlane. Stuart's recorded material for Out of Doors before, but you also have a connection to one of the producers who worked here at BBC Aberdeen back in the 1940s.
George Bruce. He had 10 years at Aberdeen, 36 to 46. Prior to that, he was at Dundee High School as a teacher, English teacher, and through a friendship with Robert Kemp and with the Perthshire poet William Souter, he managed to find an avenue into broadcasting, which served him well right through until 1970. The latter part of his career, he was based in Edinburgh, but as you rightly say, Mark, the first 10 years were here in Aberdeen.
Now, you provided us with a clip of George Bruce, and it's a great wee story.
1950, I returned to Fraserburgh in order to do a town programme. And since I'd imported one or two speakers, particularly Joseph McLeod, I thought the right thing for me to do with the new ones was take them up to the top of the lighthouse. They could see the town from there, and I could discourse on the matter. Last to arrive was Joseph McLeod, and I took him up to the lighthouse. And when I said that lighthouse keeper, Matheson, I said to him then, I said, forgive me, it's the last time, it's getting dark almost. Joseph McLeod, he said, not the Joseph McLeod, the announcer. And I said, yes. He said, oh, he said, he got in such a state, this big man, and Joseph was standing beside me. He said, come into the cottage. So I went into his cottage up there.
And when I was introduced to the lighthouse keeper, he almost burst into tears and gave me a handshake such as I've never experienced before or since. He was very deeply moved. And it turned out that years before, during the war, he had been with his mate, or assistant, or whatever it's called, on Macalflaga, I think the most northerly lighthouse in the British Isles, and they'd been shot up by the Germans. His companion was killed. Relief didn't arrive for a long time. And his one link with the world was not only the BBC, but this is what touched me so much, my particular voice, as it were, speaking to him. And he asked me if I could account for this, and something came back to my mind that at the very beginning of the war, in the phony war, I had 10 days' leave, and I took them in the south of Cornwall. And I went for a walk along to a lighthouse. It was all covered with barbed wire. You couldn't go near it. And I thought, how isolated people are, even on land, in a lighthouse. What must it be like on a promontory or an island or a rock? And I made a sort of vow that, especially in certain transmissions, I would always think of the lighthouse keepers and speak specially for them.
That I find a really fascinating story, Graham. If for no other reason than, you know, obviously we have not experienced war in this country since 1945, but we did experience COVID. And it was exactly that same sense of isolation of trying to talk to people, because I believe personally, I don't know how you feel about this, but in radio, you only ever talk to one person.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. And it was actually a broadcaster called Howard M. Lockhart, who broadcast a lot from Glasgow, but he came up to the Aberdeen station in the 1930s, and he actually on air always introduced or spoke to his audience as if they were one person. And he would actually start his programme by saying, good evening, and leave a pause for the listener to answer, and then start again, which is a novel way of doing it. But yeah, it's just about this idea that you're not talking ever to a group of people.
Yeah. Stuart, have you ever heard that clip before?
It's the first time I've heard that extent of the clip. I've heard, you know, little snippets of it, but not quite as much from Joseph McLeod. But when I was speaking to George Bruce, my interview with him was at his home in Edinburgh in February 2000. And it's one of those moments, and Graham, you'll understand it, both Rachel and Mark, when you're drawn in during an interview, that there's a moment where you suddenly realise what I'm now listening to is extra special. You're going to extract, you know, this particular segment and listen to it again. And it absolutely captivated by that particular moment.
You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. She's Rachel Stewart. As we've said before, we're not live this week. Instead, we're putting together a special programme to mark 100 years of the BBC broadcasting from Aberdeen. We've got a lovely panel of guests with us. And, of course, we've also mentioned the, reasonably live audience at this time. They're still more or less awake out there somewhere. If you miss any of this, there are a few ways of listening again.
Yeah, one of the best ways is by looking the programme up on BBC Sounds.
And you can, of course, download the Scotland Outdoors podcast available from BBC Sounds. It never ceases to astonish us where people listen to the podcast because it's all over the shop. Tell us, if you're one of those folk, you can email us at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
Now, not only was 1923 a major year for broadcasting in this area, it was also a big year for emigration. The 1920s saw huge numbers of people leaving Scotland for new opportunities overseas. Marjorie Harper is a professor of history at Aberdeen University. I asked her about what influence the radio might have had on those tuning in at home for the first time.
Well, it would have given listeners access to a wonderful new world of opportunity beyond the farm or the factory or the fish house. They would have learnt about new lands, for example, and life that was really much more exciting than the mundane existence of the northeast of Scotland.
We're standing in your lovely garden just now, and you've got terrific views of the Aberdeenshire countryside. There are bales and sheep in the fields, all lit beautifully by the low autumnal sun. But life was quite hard for people, wasn't it? Particularly in rural communities like this one in the 1920s.
It was indeed, with no mod cons. And one of the attractions of life overseas, particularly, I think, in terms of the advertising for Canada, was that there was a much more enjoyable lifestyle for even the working classes. One advertisement that really sticks in my mind appeared in the Stonehaven Journal, and this was well before the First World War, and I can even remember her name. She was called Elspeth Knowles, and she was a domestic servant who had gone out to eastern Canada, to the Maritime Provinces, and wrote a letter encouraging others to follow in her footsteps by saying that we even have a machine that does the washing, and we have pipes that take the heat around the house, so we wake up in the morning and we don't have to get dressed under the bedclothes because it's nice and warm.
What a wonderful luxury.
Yes, and certainly one that would not have been on offer in most Aberdeenshire houses at that time, or for a lot longer.
So there was mass emigration in the 1920s.
Yes, the 1920s was the first decade since records began when there was an intercensal drop in population. In other words, there were fewer people in Scotland in 1931 than there had been in 1921. And that was because there was such a hemorrhage out of the country. Not necessarily all overseas. I mean, we don't know about the numbers who went to England. Statistics weren't kept. But there was certainly a southerly movement. But there was also a very, very significant overseas movement. 1923 was the key year. 89,000 people went out in 1923.
And these were just people looking for a new life.
Yes, I think the First World War had unsettled a lot of people and made them think about opportunities, about new horizons, not least ex-servicemen who had mingled with servicemen from Commonwealth countries during war service and had heard stories about life in Canada or Australia or New Zealand, South Africa, wherever it might be, and thought, well, I wonder what that might be like, and then came back to a life that was humdrum and didn't meet the expectations that had been generated by the promises of Lloyd George during the war, that, well, particularly this is referring more to the Highlands, but that there would be homes fit for heroes. They didn't come back to homes fit for heroes. Those promises were reneged on.
The radio, of course, wouldn't have been advertising emigration as such, but there was eventually some programming that talked about new lands and new opportunities.
Yes, and some of that programming
came out in tandem with the Empire exhibition at Wembley in 1924, and some of it actually came out of Scotland. The Glasgow studio, for example, had a series called, I think it was Empire Phono Flights, that talked about overseas lands, not necessarily with a view to emigration, but just telling people about what life was like in other countries.
And for the first time, this information will have been coming straight into the listener's living room. They wouldn't have had to go and actually pursue this information or actively try to find it out for themselves.
The key difference with the radio was indeed that people could hear passively about what was on offer. In previous generations, those who were interested had to take the initiative and go to hear the lecture of an agent. They had to approach him at an agricultural show. They had to look at his display of Canadian or Australian produce, and they had to go to maybe an interview with the agent in a booking agent's office. Radio was much more immediate. It came into them in their own homes. Yes, they still had to take the initiative once they'd heard the programme, but it was brought to them in a way that was really unprecedented.
We were chatting a little earlier, and one of the lovely things you said is that radio ended up being a little bit like the bicycle. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, in the late 19th century, the bicycle opened up new opportunities, particularly for farm workers in isolated locations in rural Scotland. It gave them the opportunity to visit people in nearby farms or even further away locations in their limited leisure time. And in a similar way, the radio opened up much bigger horizons that said, well, really, there's life beyond the farm. There's life beyond the narrow confines of the employment, which seems to be my lot for my entire life. I might take up this opportunity to go overseas and better myself.
Professor Marjorie Harper there. We've still got Tom McCain from the Atherton Institute, the University of Aberdeen. There's an important principle in that too, which kind of, to a certain extent, ties in what we're talking to Stuart about. Radio is about communicating one-on-one. But the power of, you can read about it, you can look at a poster or whatever, but the power of having somebody that sounds like you, using your language to say, I am here, this is what I have managed to achieve, that can't be underestimated.
Yeah, I think that's enormous. And hearing those voices on a weekly or daily basis would have certainly changed people's sense of place, sense of scale, sense of achievability, sense of where they might go. And I'm also struck by the idea that rural isolation is a kind of new idea, in a way. You know, when you start getting depopulation and then connections to worlds other than the very local, then you suddenly have this huge gulf between people that begins to build. And so I think of rural isolation as something that's maybe 100 years old, really. Because before that, you had these very functional communities and some scale of interaction between them. And, you know, like as I said on Drumdelgi, 30 people, that's a pretty big community right there. But when that starts thinning out and you get, you know, latter part, middle of the 20th century, one person working on a tractor, maybe 20 years later, they have a radio in the tractor finally. So the radio comes back into play in rural life, reducing isolation. But I think there's a period in there when depopulation plus access to the outside created this idea of I'm alone here, or I should be somewhere else, or I could be somewhere else. It fits in, I think, with what we were talking about earlier. The concepts of beauty in the landscape have changed. You know, 200 years ago, beauty in the landscape meant it was peopled. It was run by people. It was worked. It was part of our world. Then beauty becomes emptiness and wilderness, and the idea of wilderness is a pretty modern construct, really. It's things that previous generations would have considered unnatural. This is empty landscape. Natural landscape is covered with people doing things.
And mechanization was going to change things again as well. And we heard that, you know, lovely story about someone saying, you know, you should come here because we've got washing machines. You know, hallelujah.
Yes, we think of you know, sometimes you hear people saying, oh, they had all the time in the world back then. But, you know, I get my students to take some oats in a bag and they go to a quern in the Highland Folk Museum and they grind it into oatmeal and they make oatcakes. And it takes them 3 hours to make enough oatcakes for maybe two people for one meal. So when we think of the times back then and what the work that people were doing, the level of work every day just to survive and just to keep warm in the one slightly warmed room in the house, it's no wonder that radio appealed, that the outside world appealed.
And it's interesting, the Aberdeen station was the only station in Scotland, I don't know if it's the only one in the UK, which had local dialect a big part of the output. Now, it might not be the presenters speaking in local dialects, but certainly real voices of ordinary people, what was coming through the airwaves. Also interesting that we do think always of the BBC back then as people with posh voices, and that was a big part of it, but there was local dialect there. Interestingly, John Reith had introduced this idea of what was called received pronunciation, not because he was posh or because he was educated or that he felt everyone should necessarily speak like that. Part of the reason was that people hadn't heard regional dialects before. If you're in Aberdeen or in Glasgow, you maybe don't know what somebody from Manchester or Liverpool or Cornwall sounds like. So the whole idea of having this general BBC style accent was simply so that people could understand what was being said. As simple as that.
Let's get back to our mystery sound. As we've said, we're not live today, but we do have a mystery sound for our live audience and for our guest panel. Let's have another listen.
I have been handed a clue. It says, and I don't know if this will help anybody in the audience, you would have needed this to power your radio. Tom?
Well, I'm just wondering if it has anything to do with a lead-acid battery, and you have to keep the liquid topped up in there.
The producer says you're getting very hot, and I don't know what
that
means. Let's return to Paula Williams, who's from the National Library of Scotland. You've got some fabulous books here with you. Tell me a little bit about what they are. These are maps, I think?
These are maps. I have to say that these are not from the National Library of Scotland, because the National Library of Scotland is a reference library.
And you don't want to be fired.
And I'm sure you all have these in your own attic at home. I do. So what I've brought today are some of the kinds of maps that were available in the 1920s for our lovely outdoor people to cycle and drive with. And they're kind of important because it's the first time that maps have become democratised, that they are affordable to the man in the street. They still cost about a shilling, which is not cheap, but it is affordable, particularly if you're going out in a little group. You can see that groups or clubs would club together to have a set of them. Wealthy people would have a whole set of them covering the country, and they would have lovely leather cases that would then be strapped onto their rather beautiful cars to travel around with. But obviously you could just buy the one for the area you wanted to see. They're really attractive. I'm going to pass these around in a minute. So they either have sort of cars of the time. They're sort of selling that driving out into the countryside idea. And they're rather beautiful on the inside as well, because they tend to be colour layer contours, which means that you can see how high the hills are according to the colours. You can plan your tour quite nicely.
You mentioned the Craig Dew Club earlier. Most of these guys worked in the shipyard. So, you know, they would basically finish a shift and they would get all the gear, and then quite frequently they would take the ferry up to the Arica Alps or something like that. And then, you know, overnight they would house sometimes because they didn't have tents. And then they would climb, and then it was a mad gallop to try and get back to work, you know, for first thing on the Monday morning.
I think the city sounds very exciting, and it's a whole new world, and it's an income for people, but it's very different from living in a rural community. So you can see that people would like
to get out and just dive to the nearest place. And it was often Aracher or walks in the campsites. We've got some lovely film in the Moving Image Archive of local walking clubs going off into the campsites, ladies dressed as the production team are today in their tweeds and boots.
No, they weren't.
remarkably similar with sort of normal jumpers, and the men tended to wear army surplus, so they had post-war kilts and sort of regimental jackets with all the regalia taken off, but all the pockets and big belts and hobnail boots.
I have a book, Tramping Holidays in Scotland, and a day's walk was to walk out from the centre of Glasgow out to Kilsyth, up the Tacmadoon Road. I don't know if anybody knows that road. It's crippling, absolutely crippling. Along the top of the campsites, come down to Strathblane and walk back into Glasgow. One day.
Yeah.
Absolutely extraordinary. So, Stuart, you wanted to say something too.
It was just this idea, really, that people seek wellness in the countryside. And I mentioned John Muir earlier on as one of the founding fathers, really, of the movement to protect the landscape and the countryside for people. And one of his quotes, one of his sayings, was about there being thousands of tired, nerve-shaken, over-civilized people who are beginning to find out that going to the mountains is going home, that wildness is a necessity. You know, these were words dating back to 1870.
Tell us about how the Trust came to have Glencoe, because is it true that it purchased it at a ripe, an auction?
It did. So this was going back to 1935, so the Trust had only been going for 4 years. And it sent out its lawyer, its land agent at the time, with £1,500 in his pocket. And his intention actually was to buy the Signal Rock. And he met up with another chap, and I don't know his name, who was kind of equally interested in buying a bit of Glencoe that was up for auction. And this chap said, well, do you know what? I was going to buy Signal Rock, but if I do that, I'll give it to you. So, you know, you're here for a kind of good cause, for public benefit. And I guess he was quite trusting because that's what he did. And so our man had an extra £1,200 in his pocket. So he bought the rest of Glencoe and he bought the Clackaig in, and I think did rather well out of the deal.
Joe, I'm not being funny here, but the cost aside, could you do that nowadays in the National Trust for Scotland?
I was thinking about this because...
longingly.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking that, you know, the power of decision-making these days and bureaucracy probably involved would mean now 1,000 emails or telephone calls, you know, between the
focus groups.
And, yeah, yeah.
Business plans, something like everything that. Else.
But back in the day, there was maybe a bit more bravery.
So 90 years, you know, basically the National Trust for Scotland, 100 years for us of broadcasting from BBC Aberdeen. I'm curious, I mean, we're going on the panellists, but I'd also like to hear from some of the audience too. What difference, if any, radio has actually made to your lives? How important is it? Why is it significant? Why is it significant?
Let's start with Tom.
Well, I'm probably one of the few people who saw the moon landing on radio. So we didn't have a television. I heard the moon landing in rural New Hampshire. So that was sort of the first time I sort of registered the importance of radio, being able to experience something that mankind, for want of a better term, was experiencing at that time. Quite significant.
And Paula?
You asked us earlier about sort of our first memory of radio, and I remember I must have been about 8 or 9 being given a transistor radio. I was desperate for one because my big sister had one. It was probably, I don't know, maybe 8 inches by 6, and I would listen to the top 10 every week, and it was so exciting. And it has kind of stayed with me. I listen to the radio every day.
Tom?
I could add one angle about providing a career. In the 1960s, my uncle was living in Maryland, and he taped a BBC programme called The Folk Song Cellar onto reel-to-reel tapes. And those are the tapes that I grew up, the songs that I grew up singing, which included Drumdelgi and songs from the Northeast here. N number of years later, I end up with folklore as a career and singing of these songs as a career and an avocation, as well as a vocation. So the role of the BBC's Folk Song Cellar has turned into my life, really.
What about you, Stuart?
I guess I reflect that your relationship with radio just changes over time. And, you know, growing up as a teenager in the 80s, it was all about music and it was all about listening to the radio with your mates. And then basically I stopped listening to music because good music stopped at the end of the 80s, didn't it? And I think my relationship with radio now is very different. So it's predominantly listening out with a dog or in the car. It's all about the voice now.
Graham?
Provides a career.
But it's quite handy.
The money's good.
Yeah, the money's good. It's all about money. I actually remember listening under the bed sheets when I was a kid, and I got my first personal stereo, which I thought was the most amazing thing, because personal stereos in the 1980s, people often think what was great about them is you could play tapes. I thought it was amazing there was a radio on it, because it meant you weren't just listening to the same tape that you'd bought. There was all this music you hadn't heard before and all these programmes you hadn't heard before. I just thought that was amazing, just so much choice.
MD from the audience want to say anything? Stuart?
What was quite significant growing up in the Borders was when BBC Radio Tweed, as it was, opened its doors in Selkirk in April 83. And it was the first time that I'd heard a lot of local place names referred to on a daily basis from that area. Border television covered a huge swathe of the south of the country, the Isle of Man, so it was very rare that you got a lot of detail from the area that you grew up in. So much so that April 83 coincided with just after my grandfather's retirement, and he had this wonderful spruce green and white cream top mini. And in the summer holidays, a lot of the places that I'd heard little features on and programmes on Radio Tweed when they had 25-minute specials in the evening, we'd actually go and visit these places around the Borders. So it opened up a lot of avenues and it created, I suppose, the imagination. And I tended at that time as well, I think, to absorb a lot more information through the spoken word than maybe through a written page.
Yeah, interesting. Right, we're going to reveal the mystery sound here, and I think we have a slight technical issue with this. We'll hear the mystery sound again. I'll explain what the technical issue is in a minute. The technical issue I was referring to was it's a mystery sound to me as well. And now I'm supposed to reveal it, but it turns out that you've actually got it written down.
I have, yes.
Yeah, swick.
Mark was looking to see if he had the answer somewhere in the script, but no, it was removed from your script, but it is in mine. And actually, Tom, you were spot on. The mystery sound is sucking acid out of a lead acid accumulator battery with a hydrometer to test it and squirting it back into the cell. It was required to test a cell's charge or discharge. That is the most complicated mystery sound I think we've ever had. A huge thanks then to all of our guests, Graham Stewart, Paula Williams, Stuart Brooks and Dr. Tom McGee.
We also have to give a big thank you to our audience for turning out tonight. It was very kind of you. It always comes as a surprise when people turn out, either late at night or early in the morning, but it's been lovely to see you here, and thank you very much for your time and for taking the effort to actually come here. And we will be back outside this building next Saturday. Don't forget you can download the Scotland Outdoors podcast from noon today. Until the next time, from everybody here at BBC Aberdeen, celebrating 100 years of broadcasting, thanks for listening.
Gail Katz told friends she was leaving her husband, Bob, then went missing. On season one of The Girlfriends, Bob's ex-girlfriends came together to bring him down and seek justice.
I can't believe this.
Now on season two, host Carol Fisher is back, working to solve the mystery of another missing woman.
It's almost like it's become this, you know, moral obligation to find her.
Listen to The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, and start listening.